Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. Today we're going to be talking about a subject that I think is very significant. It is a subject that I feel fits very appropriately with a holiday we had just a few days ago, Memorial Day. And it is one that I think that we need to bear in mind. And that is, it's important to be prepared. Now, that's a Boy Scout motto. It's a Girl Scout motto. I remember being taught that when I was just a kid. But it is something that we cannot assume, that where we are, what we're doing, is not going to be in danger from others that would like to destroy what we have. What is that? It's the right of freedom, the right of choice. My guest today is George Galderisi. He is a co-writer with Tom Clancy, who wrote a book, Act of Valor. This is an incredible publication. It will absolutely keep you on the edge of the seat from the very beginning of reading it to the end. And I want to welcome Captain George Galderisi. You are U.S. Navy retired, sir. Is that correct?
That's right, Donna. I did 30 years on active duty. Started out as a helicopter pilot, a couple of command tours, and then once you get to the point where you're done with your flying career, you transition to the shipboard Navy. So I had several tours in our amphibious forces and then with a carrier strike group for 5 years.
Now, you also were a senior advisor with the Center for Security Strategy and Operations in Washington, D.C. That is quite a sophisticated environment to be in, especially with all of the technology that is involved. How did you and Tom Clancy manage to get together, and also the other gentleman, Dick Couch, who served as a surface warfare officer aboard a Navy destroyer and also worked with an underwater demolition team and SEAL Team 1? Tell us how the three of you got together.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story, Donna. It's one of those things that you have to tell yourself as much as you think you plan your life out. Some things just happen, and in this case, things happened for the better. Dick Couch and I, of course, are the co-authors of Tom Clancy Presents Act of Valor. Dick, like myself, is a Naval Academy graduate. He was a few years ahead of me at the Academy. And we've teamed up on writing projects in the past. We've probably known each other for about a dozen years. And very coincidentally, Dick and I found ourselves in Coronado, California. I'm from Coronado. Dick was in Coronado for other reasons. And Dick's done about 15 books. So Dick is a professional writer. That's the main thing he does after he finished his career as a Navy SEAL, and he also worked for the CIA. Dick and I had lunch with a fellow named Mike Mouse McCoy, who's the CEO of an outfit in Los Angeles called Bandito Brothers. And Dick had done a book for the Naval Institute called Sheriff of Ramadi, which Bandito Brothers was interested in perhaps optioning for a film. And we had lunch. Dick just invited me as a friend, since he was in Coronado anyway. Had lunch with Mike McCoy, and then very spontaneously, Mike said, "Hey, we've just done this film called Act of Valor. We've got it in the can. We're showing it to focus groups. You guys are both former military guys. Dick, you're a SEAL. It's about Navy SEALs. Would you have time to come up to our business in Culver City and see the film?" And Dick and I said, "Yeah, sure, that'd be great." So about 2 weeks later, we went up to Culver City. Donna, we watched this pre-release version of Act of Valor, and I have to tell you, it's the most riveting 100 minutes of film I've seen in my life.
Wow.
Dick and I were exhausted after we saw it. In fact, we walked out of their little 8-person theater, and we said to each other, "I'm not sure we're safe to drive home." So that was that for the, for that screening. We sat down with Mouse McCoy and his COO Max Liebman, and we talked about what we saw, and we gave them some mild advice. I mean, the film was great. That I think we just had to offer some suggestions around the edges. And after we talked about that, there was a lull in the conversation, and I turned to Mike and I said, "Well, so who's doing the novelization of this movie?" And Mike turned to his COO, Max, and said, "Max, who's doing the novelization?" And Max said, "Nobody. We've been so busy making this film that we haven't had time to think about that." So we started talking with them. Our agent, John Silversack of Triad Media Group, talked with the Bandito Brothers folks, and then subsequently with Relativity Media, who they sold the film to and who distributed the film. And one thing led to another, and they asked us to come aboard and do the novelization. So, Donna, here's where Tom Clancy comes in. Tom Clancy saw a screening of Act of Valor. He fell in love with the movie. It represented the principles that he stands for, and he thought it was a terrific film. And he said, "I want to be attached to this." Well, this film stars Navy SEALs. There's no Johnny Depp. There's no Angelina Jolie. There's no big-name stars. Relativity had bought the film. They put a lot of money into marketing the film. The one thing they didn't have was star power. So by having Tom Clancy attached to the film, they thought that was a very good thing, and the film did fabulously well, so it turned out to be a good bet. Because he was attached to the film, he automatically became attached to the book. So Dick and I were well into writing the book. Tom Clancy and his syndicate became attached. He was kind enough to write a foreword for the book, which he read, and was absolutely wonderful about putting a link in to the Naval Special Warfare Foundation, which takes care of the families of SEALs that have fallen in battle. So it was a nice association. He did a very very wonderful forward, and that's kind of how we all happened to link up.
Now, that it's amazing to me that there was a movie done first. None of you were related, and the novel has come afterwards. I find that that is just a fast. Usually it's the other way around, but this time you guys took something that was in the film and just, wow, this is amazing.
Well, no, thanks for bringing that up, Donna. You're exactly right. I'd say, I mean, I'm not in the movie business, but I'm a reader and a movie watcher, and I'd say probably 85% to 90% of novels and movies, the way the relationship goes is exactly how you've described. A movie studio, a production company will option the novel, and then they'll make a movie of it. But here's why this happened this way. In 2001, 9/11, which, you know, was so impactful on everyone in America, happened, and both at the presidential level and in the office of the Secretary of Defense, people realized that special forces, Navy, Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, would really be in the forefront of the nation's wars in the future. And that has panned out, as you well know, exactly as they predicted in Iraq and Afghanistan. So all the services were given a quota to bring in more special operators because they just didn't have enough. And the SEALs were given a quota to bring in 500 more SEALs in the next 5 years.
Wow.
Sounds easy, but if you know anything about SEAL training, the attrition rate in SEAL training is about 85%.
Yes, it is.
So the SEALs, which are usually, and all special operators, which are usually very close-mouthed about what they do, and they're called the quiet professionals, said, you know, we need some help with recruiting because we need to get the word out to attract young men 19 to 25 years old to SEAL training. So they decided to do a commercial. They realized that within the Navy, the talent didn't exist to do that professionally. They reached out to the media. This outfit, Bandito Brothers, did a commercial for them. It was very well received. It helped with recruiting for SEALs and also for the SWCCs, the Special Warfare Combatant Craft Crewmen, that we talk about in the book. And that was great. They did the commercial, and everyone was happy in it, and it succeeded. And then the Naval Special Warfare community, which, again, is not just SEALs but intelligence professionals and the Special Warfare Combatant Craft Crewmen I just mentioned, said, you know, we still need to attract people over the long term, and there have been some things done about the SEAL community that haven't been exactly accurate. They haven't gotten all the press in a good way they might necessarily need. So let's do a documentary about the SEALs, and we'll do a documentary to both attract young men to be SEALs, to document what the SEALs are doing and let America know more about what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you're in the media business, and you probably know documentary usually doesn't spell wild success in getting distributed, but be that as it may, they auditioned several companies for that, Bandito Brothers, because not just of their work on the commercial they did, but also some of their award-winning cinematography, Step Into Liquid and things like that, got the award to do that. Now, let me slow down a little bit. All that they got, the Navy or the Department of Defense didn't pay them a dime. They merely were given access to SEAL training. So the SEAL said, we want to do this documentary. We will invite you into training that no one has ever gotten to see before. And so the Navy didn't get a ship underway or an aircraft in the air to support this. They just said, hey, on June 3rd and 4th, we're going to be training down in Biloxi, Mississippi, and you're welcome to bring your people down at your expense and film it. Right. And that's what they did. And because there were no special events put together for Bandito Brothers, the filming took over 2 years. They just showed up when they were invited to show up. And they eventually shot about 1,800 hours of film.
Oh, my
And
goodness.
Somewhere along the way, Donna, someone said, you know, this video we've got is riveting. We've never seen anything like it before. What if we put a plot together and a high concept? And what if we had some villains? And what if we had some family members? Then we wouldn't have a documentary. We would really have a story. And we'd have a movie. And so it transitioned to that. Because that was not cheap, the Bandito Brothers went to, I believe it was Legends, which is a media venture capital firm. They borrowed some money and completed this movie. So, yeah, there was never a novel to begin with, and quite frankly, there never was a story. Kurt Johnstead, who's a very well-known filmmaker, he did The 300 and other big-name movies. He wrote a script that they used to sort of help themselves be organized in making this film. But you're exactly right. There wasn't a novel first, so novelization came after the fact.
Well, one of the things that has always been in my awareness with the SEALs when I became acquainted with who they were and what they did, and I think Tom Clancy said it very well in his very first sentence in the foreword, Navy SEALs are Olympic athletes that kill people for a living, but they never get to stand up on a podium at the end of the race, heads bowed in anticipation of a gold medal while the national anthem plays overhead, and they're a very special breed of people. That is something that absolutely is true, because anyone that wants to try out for the SEALs, regardless of the branch of service, they can do it. And what I was so impressed with as I became more aware of the SEALs, and I'm far removed from knowing, let's say, 90% of it, but one of the things that really impressed me is that when a man was not going to stay with the SEALs, either mentally, psychologically, emotionally, physically, he opted to bow out, there was no disrespect. There was no putting him down in any way, shape, or form, because this is a very, very special breed of person. And that sounds rather cold when I say it, I'm sure, to those that are listening. But it takes something that is just incredible to create a unity among these men. And I've seen things like this demonstrated in different ways, but it is a very, very special grouping of individuals. And what they do in their training, gee whiz, I mean, I just listen to it and I go, I don't think if I were a guy, I'd even be remotely, but yet I can totally understand why it would be. It's really a challenge. What would you say to a young man that wants to go into the field? Oh, my goodness. We lost our guest just real quickly, so, yeah, we'll get him right back. Let me tell you a little bit about this book, because it is so phenomenal. Act of Valor is about a group of men, highly trained, who have a very special job to do. And they'll go into harm's way where nobody else is going to even consider it. And I think that, oh, great. Hi. George, are you back with me?
We're back with you, Donna.
Oh, great. I was just absolutely intrigued with the characterizations that you have in this book. You have Rourke, who is the, I'll call him the big kahuna, but actually he doesn't put himself truly above anybody else. But this team, did you base this on when you and your associates were putting all of this information together, did you base these stories on real people that you had known? Because this team was comprised of very, very individualistically styled personalities.
Oh, no, very much so. Well, first of all, I mean, just for emphasis, the stars of this movie, who then, you know, for us transitioned into the book, were active duty Navy SEALs who, subsequent to the filming of their training that was used to make the movie, all stayed on active duty. They went back to Iraq or Afghanistan and were doing, you know, the heroic things in the field they were doing before this movie ever happened. So for people like Rourke Denver, who's the real name of the lieutenant in the movie, who we, you know, in the movie is called Rourke Engel. You know, there were character traits as far as his height and his those things that we just carried forward based on the real person. For some of the other SEALs, again, I think to give them more granularity, I mean, we didn't sit down and interview them and say, gee, what part of the country are you from, and, you know, what's your wife's name, and those sorts of things, because there is a focus with the SEALs of keeping their anonymity for obvious
Absolutely.
Reasons. So I think each character that we created was a composite. The nice thing about seeing the movie once and reading the Kurt Johnstead script is it gave us a lot of creative freedom. In other words, the script wasn't the screenplay wasn't so detailed that we were just coloring between the lines. We said, okay, we have a bunch of folks to, not just the SEALs, but their family members to create background about. So we got that fun, creative freedom to put into the book.
Well, it's absolutely mesmerizing. The characters, you have got Otto Miller, who's an intelligence specialist. You've got Diego Wyme, who is a lead sniper. Raymond Diamond, who you called the geek, that was my term that I made my notes. Sonny Gilbert, who was really skilled with automatic weapons. Alfonso Joseph Martin, who was the point man. And Mike Bennett, who was a medic. Now, here you have a combination of not just superior intelligence. These people are problem solvers. They're thinkers. And when they form a team, it is a patterning of working with the strengths of each person. And I really also liked what Tom Clancy said. He said the SEALs are gifted athletes, but they're not just fighters. They're thinkers as well, which is just repeating what I've said. And I think that that is something that people don't realize, that these individuals in the SEALs are given such incredible training, and they each have their strengths, as your characters portray, and together as a unit, they are absolutely phenomenal. And up until recently, unless you were a part of the SEAL group or you happened to have some kind of an association or see some things that were done, like my husband did when he was growing up in Virginia, he watched the Navy SEALs training, and it just blew him away when he found out what was going on. And it was done in freezing temperatures, just all kinds of things. The average individual, when they look at this film, they say, nah, this can't possibly be happening. But those on the inside track know that this is real. This is training that they go through. How long a period is it that the NEAL SEALs go through training?
In general, Donna, and it varies between units, but including their, you know, their initial underwater demolition training and those sorts of things, from the time someone walks in the gate of the Naval Special Warfare Command initially till the time they deploy with a unit, actually, you know, go forward, it's probably about 2 years. And there's a reason for that. Because, as you mentioned, and with our cast, with our platoon, you've got a small number of folks, and as we detailed in the book and as you saw, you'll see in the movie, each person had several tasks that they had to do, whether they were a medic or a weapons guy. But you think about that, it's necessary because the SEALs are all operate in small units.
Mm-hmm.
So as opposed to an Army battalion where there's, first of all, there's a great number of much larger number of folks, or a Navy ship where there's a larger number of folks, there's also no one else to check with. In other words, once you're out in the field, you do have communications, but you're making decisions on the fly. In football parlance, you're calling audibles at the line of scrimmage. So therefore, those people have to be trained that you can't, it's not like a Navy ship where if something happens, you ask the captain, because that's what captains are there for. You have to be, so that it does require more intense training. It requires putting them in situations where they have to make a decision in training. They may make the wrong decision, but that's part of the learning process, that eventually they get to the point where they're making the right decisions. And then again, you know, going back to Tom Clancy, I guess, quite honestly, if Dick and I had could change one thing in his forward, it would have been that first line that they're Olympic athletes who kill people. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's not what they go out in the field primarily to do. They go out in the field to accomplish a mission, and they're always taking, you know, the approach that we want to bring all our people back, but we're not going out to kill people just to kill people willy-nilly. So they are, like you said, you use the word thinking men. They are thinking men. They're thinking men who have to plan and execute a mission in the absence of overarching or mega management from above, and that's been the secret to their success.
Yes, they are very much self-sufficient, intelligent, well-trained, and physically very, very strong individuals. You call them in the book A-type personalities. Now, I want to touch on an evil character, which is Christo. Christo is not a figment of imagination. This personality does exist in multiple levels in life. And you have to do due diligence, because this character is more about money and profit and really doesn't have much care for anybody or anything other than being in a position of total flexibility and freedom to do whatever he wants to do, regardless of the harm that will bring to others. This character comes into play, but there are so many other levels in this book that are really based on fact. And it really lets someone know of all the various components that may go in to creating an action play. An order that will go out for certain things to be done. There's just this amazing multiple level of information that is given and organized throughout the book. It is just totally riveting, including the information on many of the personal lives of the various characters and how they, as individuals in getting married, they pick women that are just as independent and strong as they are.
Well, no, and I think that, you know, again, and that's that does mirror reality. There was no, one of the things about the when people talk about writing novels, it's suspending disbelief, and you know, you can suspend disbelief so far that your readers go, I don't believe this. But if you think about the way not just SEALs but all naval or all special warfare people. Have operated in the last 10 years, I think it's fair to say they're deployed more frequently and with less notice than anyone else in the military. And then if you think of it from a family perspective, if your spouse isn't a little bit type A and fairly self-sufficient, the whole family thing breaks down. I mean, and that's mm-hmm. part of, I think, the pact that a young person would make when they decide to go into SEAL training is that, you know, they'll sit down at the family dinner table and they'll honestly tell their spouse or the significant other, this is what my life's going to be like. And there are people who, for good and sufficient reasons, say, you know, that's not for us.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't think we could endure that kind of separation. And it's not in a negative way that those people are any less wonderful than people who enter SEAL training, but it does take a certain type of individual to be a SEAL spouse, to be the mom and the dad and the bill payer and the person who fixed the plumbing when it breaks down, et cetera, et cetera. It takes a special spouse, and I think most SEALs are blessed to have that kind of family support.
Well, I would concur, because it's just an incredible career decision to make, and the spouse would have to understand that and would have to have that sense of self-sufficiency. You give so much information about technology that some of it didn't surprise me. I was aware of it, but I really was astonished about the headphones that were used. I thought, my goodness, this is just amazing technology, and they can wear it. They only have to barely whisper. They can be heard. I mean, this is such sophisticated technology. And then what was really amazing to me was the ceramic vest. I had no clue about that. And this is described down to the detail. Tiny ceramic ball bearings, 500 of them woven into a vest. And then the inner lining of the vest is filled with a new generation of explosive gel. This just, I was sort of holding my breath when I read this, because I was thinking of airport security. Somebody could walk through this with this thing, and I'm going, oh, my goodness. This is just absolutely phenomenal. And this is based on fact.
Well, Donna, that's something that Dick and I can't take any credit for. That was something that comes directly from the movie. And again, when you see, by the way, the DVD of this movie comes out on June 5th, so you're not far away from being able to get the DVD or see it on Netflix or something. But anyway, no, that was shown very vividly in the movie. So that was an area where Dick and I, you know, we didn't use any of our prior military expertise, and we certainly didn't delve into any classified areas. We went like, wow. Our reaction was the same as yours, like, wow, this is really scary. So we pretty much colored between the lines on what was in the movie and in Kurt Johnstedt's script on that one.
Well, this book is totally mesmerizing because of all of the information that you have going on here. You've got mercenary pilots that are here. You go into the insurgent action in Africa. You have this, like I said, it is absolutely gripping, it display of action that goes on throughout the entire book. But it really does educate you about the SEALs, and maybe not as detailed a way, but in so many ways, just an incredible amount of information. And I thought, wow, what about security? Is this something that when you put this book together that you were concerned about, you know, along with your associate Dick Couch, were you concerned that there might be something here that should not be written?
You know, we weren't. Like I said, we went from the movie and from the script, and, you know, Dick and I have written before. We've written military fiction and nonfiction, and I guess it's just part of the discipline is you learn to firewall your day job, if you will, from what you put into fiction. And quite frankly, a huge percentage of the research we did was on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the caliber of a certain weapon? What's the what's the size of this boat, or what weapons does this boat have, et cetera, et cetera. So that information's out there, and like all I can tell you is we were extraordinarily cautious about putting that in there. And again, just so you know, the same process I mentioned earlier in the interview that when the Bandito brothers had finished filming all of the SEAL training, they had 1,800 hours of film. Every hour of that film was watched by professionals at the Naval Special Warfare Command to do just that, make sure that nothing secure was divulged. And then when we finished writing the book, we put it through the same process. We said, we want you to look at this, and if there's anything we've divulged that by mistake we shouldn't have divulged. So, yeah, we were very cautious to do that, but you're exactly right to raise the question, because it's something one would hope all writers are cognizant of, and you're probably aware there have been books that have come out with that shouldn't come out, some publisher mm-hmm. where someone has been irresponsible, and next thing you know, what they had in there has been redacted, but it's kind of too late. So I'm not patting ourselves on the back, saying we're very mindful of that, because the people in the Naval Special Warfare community are our friends. And so shame on us if we divulged anything that would put anyone in any kind of harm's way.
I agree. Act of Valor. Tom Clancy, Dick Couch, George.
Donna, are you still with me?
Yes, I'm still with you. I'm still with you. I think we have... Hello? Anyway, we're just about ready to close out Act of Valor. Dick Couch and George Galderisi. This book is dedicated to the men and women of the United States Special Operations Command, who for the last 10 years and counting have been on continuous deployment in harm's way to protect our freedoms. Their service and their sacrifice, together with that of their sister armed services, have kept our nation safe and free from a recurrence of the events of 9/11. Act of Valor. It is dynamic. The stories are it's just absolutely, as I said to you before, gripping. Once you pick up the book, you're not going to be able to turn it down, and you're not going to be able to put it down and just make it a part of your summer reading. It's just wonderful. Go to George Galderisi's website, and that's George, Galdorisi. You can also go to the website Act of Valor. On June 10th, the DVD is coming out, which I am anxious to see. They also have a Facebook page that's up, Act of Valor. It gives you a view into the lives of men who are very dedicated and have to be incredibly trained and are very, very special people. They are the warriors of the 21st century. George Galderisi, thank you so much for being my guest today. It has been absolutely an amazing book to go through, and I'm so pleased that we were able to get together for this interview. Thank you for being with me. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects?
Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain?
Well, I'm in paradise. I have the same problems you have. Cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Topperson.
Pain relief and healing cream.
Topperson relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Topperson and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you.
We know you're hurt.
We want to help.
We are so sure that Topperson will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee.
So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Topperson. Topperson is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans.
Ask for Topperson or call
1-800-959-1007 for store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Topperson, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
And welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a call if you'd like to chat. If you'd like for me to give you a little bit of insight, I'd be delighted to do that too. 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I wanted to share with you a wonderful, wonderful piece of writing. And I think that it is so profound, I could not share it. And it's part of a legacy that the character Rourke leaves his son because of what happens to him in battle, and it's cherished by the entire family. This is how it reads. Live your life that the fear of death never enters your heart. Trouble no one about his religion. Respect others and their views and demand they respect yours. Love your life, perfect your life, and beautify all things in your life. Seek to make your life long and of service to your people. When your time comes to die, be not like those whose hearts are filled with fear of death, so that when their time comes, they weep and pray for a little more time to live their lives over again in a different way. Sing your death song and die like a hero going home. That's out of the book, Act of Valor. An incredible read. I just really recommend it highly. I think it gives an insight into a part of a world that most of us will never, ever know. But it also gives you an awareness of what the families and those individuals go through and how their world, in its particular play of action, has a very significant impact on ours. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat at 888-627-6008. Well, I've got some fun information to share with you here that I just think is who would have known. Again, you'll hear me say periodically through different shows if you're a regular listener, there's all kinds of surveys going on. You often wonder why these things are funded, but for some reason, somebody considers them interesting. Are you aware that your hometown can affect how well you sleep? Mm-hmm. The Journal of Clinical Medicine, Clinical Sleep Medicine, said the prevalence of sleep disturbance and daytime fatigue among nearly 160,000 adults across 36 states and regions. Well, they find a difference in how people sleep. That wouldn't come as a big surprise to me. And it's independent of factors like latitude and the weather. Apparently, the South is loaded with sleep-deprived folks. Well, if they did the survey during the summer and you don't have air conditioning, that wouldn't be a big surprise. Now, here are the five best areas to be in, according to this research. I don't know exactly how thorough this was. But for the few sleep disturbances, Delaware, U.S. Virgin Islands, North Dakota, Hawaii, and Washington, D.C. Now, that one surprised me about Washington, D.C. The five worst areas where there seemed to be the most sleep disturbances was West Virginia, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama. And it doesn't surprise me with that at all. Having lived in some of those areas for short periods of time, that's just how I find. And then, yes, sniffing herbs, oils, fragrances, they are just finding all kinds of stuff, especially related to sleep. If you feel like you're going into that sleepy, dozy cycle around 3 in the afternoon, that was something that used to bother me quite a bit. And especially when I was in school, I found that because I was up so early in the morning and I did most of my physical activity, swimming and everything else, early in the day, by the time between 1 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was just ready to crash. It was just, I could barely keep my eyes open. And of course, when I was in school, I had all my heavy academic stuff in the afternoon. So I didn't do as well as I probably could have if they had been put in the morning cycle. But the UK have a number of researchers that are involved with their Brain Performance and Nutrition Research Center at Northumbria University. And they found that rosemary oil caused people to just perform so much better. Yeah, that's right, rosemary oil. They would have them just sort of smell it anywhere from 4 to 10 minutes. They found people that had the longest exposure and the highest blood levels of a particular brain-boosting compound that is actually in the oil. They've actually been able to separate it. Perform better on mental tests of speed and accuracy than those with a lower level. Well, the next thing we might see at business meetings is if people are getting a little bit of groggy is not a cup of caffeine, but maybe they're going to have a little vial of rosemary oil that they very discreetly can smell, and all of a sudden they're going to be wide awake, bushy-tailed, and, well, maybe not bushy-tailed, but ready to go to work and to do things more efficiently and accurately. But who would have thought rosemary oil? Rosemary is a wonderful fragrance, and it's used in so many different dishes, and I like it. But I would never have thought that the oil itself would have such a significant impact. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. I'll be delighted. The light of your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, we are going to have a replay of a program that was done last week. I'm speaking at the Chamber of Commerce in Silverdale, Washington, tomorrow. And because of the timing of the speaking engagement, I'm not going to be able to do a live show. But I am going to be back on Thursday live. And if you missed the show last week on healing, I think you're really going to enjoy the program that is going to be replayed for you. So that's going to be done tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we're going to be talking with Michael Elgeon. We're going to be talking about preparing for the landing. This is a man, along with a co-author, that he's had a number of experiences that he shares, and they talk about how it has impacted their lives in a very significant way. So I just thought I would share that with you. And what I wanted to do also, when we talk about energy, there's so much we don't understand about energy. There's so many different demonstrations of energy. There are so many ways that it demonstrates itself. One of the most profound effects of energy demonstration is lightning. And I have been so fascinated with how, one, it's so very, very dangerous, but two, having experienced, seen, and been around lightning balls in Florida when I was a kid. And if you've never experienced it, it's really quite an awesome thing. You will have, when the thunderstorms go on, and sometimes there might not be any rain, it's just the energy that the storm itself is producing, and all of a sudden there is this ball of lightning. And it will travel all around and right in front of you, and it will come in an amazing way. You just are shocked, and then it will disappear. So having experienced that when I was a child in Florida, when we were in Miami, my dad was going to be going to work in that area, or so we thought, and we knew at between 2 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there always were these storms that were coming through. You could depend on them. It was just absolutely guaranteed. And at that time, you were warned you did not, under any circumstances, touch anything. You were just to stay still, because if you came in contact with a television or anything metal, you could be electrocuted. So I remember this one particular experience where we were aware of a storm. It was that time of day, and my mother and I just sat very, very quietly, and here were these lightning balls that came into our house that we were in. So this is something, I've got some stories to share with you here about how lightning has done some absolutely amazing things. It's been documented and recorded. Well, I don't know that we'll ever understand it. We'll be taking a break, and after the break, when I share those stories with you, I'm also going to be sharing a wonderful story about Mary Knight and her family and how they overcame a very, very difficult series of circumstances. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you want to chat, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believe in?
Hi, this is Donna Sebo.
Thompson is a homeopathic brain that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.thompson.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Thompson online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. You should give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Thompson, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about upcoming guests, for travel schedules, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life.
You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com.
That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is Donna@delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. I promised you some information about some lightning experiences. This particular one that I'm going to be sharing with you occurred in the 1800s. Now, ball lightning, like I was talking about before we went on break, in this particular place, they skipped down from a treetop. It went down one branch at a time, avoided going in the mud puddles in a yard, went over to a barn where two children were staying in its shelter because it was raining pretty hard outside. The sphere was low enough to the ground. One of the children actually kicked the lightning sphere. And when the child kicked it, it exploded. Every one of the 11 cows that was in the stable was killed. Now figure that one out. That is really, really strange. In the 1800s, again, in France, three women and a child were in their house. Ball lightning entered through the chimney, went around the room, passed to the kitchen, went into another room, then it went into a stable. And it passed over dry straw. Straw did not catch on fire. It touched a pig, vanished. The pig died. Ball lightning circling a little kitten and a little girl. When the ball lightning disappeared, the kitten was dead. The little girl was unharmed. So many stories. But this one, I thought, really was intriguing. In 1953, in Ermelo, South Africa, lightning struck a South African boy while he was leading a team of eight oxen, and he was pulling a very heavy plow. Now, the boy was knocked unconscious and was just about to be trampled and crushed when the lightning came back, struck again, it killed the animals, all eight of them, and the boy's life was spared. It's almost as if there is an intelligence with this energy. And when I came across this information, I thought, with these descriptions, it's as if the intelligence is curious. It wants to know things. It's as if it has a form of discernment. I know, I'm getting a little sci-fi here, but I will tell you, it is absolutely amazing. And in 1972, lightning cut circles in window glass at the meteorology department in the University of Edinburgh. Fascinating stuff. And there's even more stories that are recorded. For those of you that may have a member of your family that is experiencing Alzheimer's, I wanted to share some very special information with you that I just became aware of, and that is a bracelet that has been developed for people that have Alzheimer's. I have known so many people whose family members, as the Alzheimer's progresses, they will wander. I had a friend whose father's Alzheimer's was very, very bad, and he went through a lot of emotional shifts, and many times he would decide he wanted to go somewhere, and they would lock him in a room, and he would undo the hinges on the door so that he could open the door and leave. I mean, this man was extremely intelligent, and even though he had Alzheimer's, for some reason, he remembered how to do things. And so he'd undo doors, he'd undo... No, I mean, it was just a constant concern. Well, they didn't have this bracelet then. It's called the MCQ, and that's E-M, like Mary, S like Sam, E-E-Q. And it is specifically for people that have Alzheimer's. It's the only cellular-based emergency locator, and it is really a help. It can be activated to call 911, enabling a quick and safe recovery. And more than 100 people to date have been rescued. Now, it's not inexpensive. It's $225 plus a $35 monthly service fee. And you can find out about this by going to mfinders.com. That's E-M-F-I-N-D-E-R-S.com. And every so often here in the Seattle area, we'll hear about someone who has just wandered off. And even though the family is very diligent or the caretakers are diligent, sometimes you get distracted and the next thing you know, your patient or your loved one is out roaming about. So this is important, I think, to share. Again, that's mfinders.com, E-M-F-I-N-D-E-R-S. And with nothing else, for the sum that was quoted, it would give a peace of mind that I think would make a great deal of difference because they get totally disoriented and it's very frightening for them. I wanted to share this story about Mary Knight because this is, I think, very significant. Mary had a stepdaughter whose name was Tiffany, and they just got along fabulously. So many times when people marry and there are children that are like 11 or 12 years old, there can be a lot of challenges with that. Well, Tiffany was considered a miracle child. She had had only a 1 in a million chance of living. She was born with one non-functioning kidney, and the other kidney was operating only at 10%. They were also concerned because of this that she had mental disabilities. And she was put on a transplant list as at the age of 11. Well, 2 years after this marriage, Mary and her husband got the good news that Tiffany was going to get a new kidney. And this was going to really be a challenge because after getting the new kidney, she was going to have round-the-clock care. And that meant that Mary was going to have to stop working. She was going to have to be the full-time caregiver, and Richard was going to continue with making the income that was necessary. And she really, really changed because of this experience. And she'd had the surgery. The surgery went well. Little Tiffany was doing very, very well. There was a conversation that Mary had with Tiffany, and again, it was about a month after the surgery. Tiffany turned to Mary, her stepmother, and said, "You know, Mary, I came here for you." Now stop and think about this. Mary heard those words, and they really stuck with her. She said, being with Tiffany and hearing those words coming out of her young mouth took any fears that she had about being an adequate caretaker away. She said, the fear of giving myself over to another human being, I found myself more comfortable with the giving. Now, Tiffany went on to live an additional 25 years longer than the doctors ever expected. And with this transplant, she's going to be living a lot longer as well. And she said, those 3 months that I spent as Tiffany's caregiver transformed my life. And her words, you know, Mary, I came here for you, were very real. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have an utterly magnificent day or evening wherever you are. And I look forward to sharing time with you again tomorrow versus the replay, and then back in studio on Thursday, live. Talk to you then, here on BBSRadio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to the Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.